Missy. He dialed an inside number. Lieutenant Flat is our liaison with Birmingham. Yeah, Flat. What about the Jacoby's dog? Just a minute. He put his hand over the phone. No dog. They found a litter box in the downstairs bathroom with cat droppings in it. They didn't find any cat. The neighbors are watching for it. Could you ask Birmingham to check around in the yard and behind any outbuildings? Graham said. If the cat was hurt, the children might not have found it in time and they might have buried it. You know how cats do. They hide to die. Dogs come home. And would you ask if it's wearing a collar? Tell them if they need a methane probe, we'll send one, Crawford said. Save a lot of digging. Springfield relayed the request. The telephone rang as soon as he hung it up. The call was for Jack Crawford. It was Jimmy Price at the Lombard Funeral Home. Crawford punched on from the other phone. Jack, I got a partial. It's probably a thumb and a fragment of a palm. Jimmy, you're the light of my life. I know. The partial's a tented arch, but it's smudged. I'll have to see what I can do with it when I get back. Came off the oldest kid's left eye. I never did that before. Never would have seen it, but it stood out against an eight-ball hemorrhage from the gunshot wound. Can you make an identification off it? It's a very long shot, Jack. If he's in the single print index, maybe, but that's like the Irish sweepstakes, you know that. The palm came off the nail of Mrs. Leeds' left big toe. It's only good for comparison. We'll be lucky to get 6 points off it. The assistant SAC witnessed, and so did Lombard. He's a notary. I've got pictures in situ. Will that do it? What about elimination prints on the funeral home employees? I inked up Lombard and all his merry men, major case prints, whether they said they had touched her or not. They're scrubbing their hands and bitching now. Let me go home, Jack. I want to work these up in my own dark room. Who knows what's in the water here? Turtles. Who knows? I can catch a plane to Washington in an hour and fax the prints down to you by early afternoon. Crawford thought a moment. Okay, Jimmy, let's step on it. Copies to Atlanta and Birmingham PDs and bureau offices. You got it. Now, something else we've got to get straight on your end. Crawford rolled his eyes to the ceiling. Gonna piss in my ear about the per diem, aren't you? Right. Today, Jimmy, my lad, nothing's too good for you. Graham stared out the window while Crawford told them about the prince. That's, by God, remarkable, was all Springfield said. Graham's face was blank, closed like a lifer's face, Springfield thought. He watched Graham all the way to the door. The Public Safety Commissioner's news conference was breaking up in the foyer as Crawford and Graham left Springfield's office. The print reporters headed for the phones. Television reporters were doing cutaways, standing alone before their cameras, asking the best questions they had heard at the news conference, and extending their microphones to thin air for a reply that would be spliced in later from film of the commissioner. Crawford and Graham had started down the front steps when a small man darted ahead of them, spun, and took a picture. His face popped up behind his camera. "Will Graham," he said. "Remember me? Freddie Lowndes. I covered the Lecter case for the Tatler. I did the paperback." "I remember," Graham said. He and Crawford continued down the steps, Lowndes walking sideways ahead of them. "When did they call you in, Will? What have you got?" "I won't talk to you, Lowndes." "How does this guy compare with Lecter? Does he do them..." "Lowndes." Graham's voice was loud, and Crawford got in front of him fast. "Lowndes, you right-lying shit, and the National Tatler is an asswipe. Keep away from me." Crawford gripped Graham's arm. "Get away, Lowndes. Go on. Will, let's get some breakfast. Come on, Will." They rounded the corner, walking swiftly. "I'm sorry, Jack. I can't stand that bastard. When I was in the hospital, he came in and..." "I know it," Crawford said. "I reamed him out. Much good it did." Crawford remembered the picture in the National Tattler at the end of the Lecter case. Lowndes had come into the hospital room while Graham was asleep. He flipped back the sheet and shot a picture of Graham's temporary colostomy. The paper ran it retouched with a black square covering Graham's groin. The caption said, "Crazy Guts Cop." The diner was bright and clean. Graham's hands trembled, and he slopped coffee in his saucer. He saw Crawford's cigarette smoke bothering a couple in the next booth. The couple ate in a peptic silence, their resentment hanging in the smoke. Two women, apparently mother and daughter, argued at a table near the door. They spoke in low voices, anger ugly in their faces. Graham could feel their anger on his face and neck. Crawford was griping about having to testify at a trial in Washington in the morning. He was afraid the trial could tie him up for several days. As he lit another cigarette, he peered across the flame at Graham's hands and his color. "Atlanta and Birmingham can run the thumbprint against their known sex offenders," Crawford said. "So can we. And Price has dug a single print out of the files before. He'll program the finder with it. We've come a long way with that, just since you left." Finder, the FBI's automated fingerprint reader and processor, might recognize the thumbprint on an incoming fingerprint card from some unrelated case. "When we get him, that print and his teeth will put him away," Crawford said. "What we have to do, we have to figure on what he could be. We have to swing a wide loop. Indulge me now. Say we've arrested a good suspect. You walk in and see him. What is there about him that doesn't surprise you?" "I don't know, Jack. God damn it, he's got no face for me. We could spend a lot of time looking for people we've invented. Have you talked to Bloom?" "On the phone last night. Bloom doubts he's suicidal, and so does Heimlich. Bloom was only here a couple of hours the first day, but he and Heimlich have the whole file. Bloom's examining PhD candidates this week. He said tell you hello. Do you have his number in Chicago?"
"I have it."
Graham liked Dr. Alan Bloom, a small, round man with sad eyes, a good forensic psychiatrist, maybe the best. Graham appreciated the fact that Dr. Bloom had never displayed professional interest in him. That was not always the case with psychiatrists. "Bloom says he wouldn't be surprised if we heard from the Tooth Fairy. He might write us a note," Crawford said, "on a bedroom wall. Bloom thinks he might be disfigured, or he may believe he's disfigured. He told me not to give that a lot of weight. I won't set up a straw man to chase, Jack, is what he told me. That would be a distraction and would diffuse the effort. Said they taught him to talk like that in graduate school."
"He's right," Graham said.
"You could tell something about him, or you wouldn't have found that fingerprint," Crawford said. "That was the evidence on the damn wall, Jack. Don't put this on me. Look, don't expect too much from me, all right?" "Oh, we'll get him. You know we'll get him, don't you?"
"I know it, one way or the other."
"What's one way?"
"We'll find evidence we've overlooked."
"What's the other?"
"He'll do it, and do it until one night he makes too much noise going in, and the husband gets to a gun in time."
"No other possibilities?"
"You think I'm going to spot him across a crowded room?"
"No. That's Itzio Pinza you're thinking about, does that? The Tooth Fairy will go on and on until we get smart or get lucky. He won't stop."
"Why?"
"Because he's got a genuine taste for it." "See? You do know something about him," Crawford said. Graham did not speak again until they were on the sidewalk.
"Wait until the next full moon," he told Crawford. "Then tell me how much I know about him."
Graham went back to his hotel and slept for 2.5 hours. He woke at noon, showered, and ordered a pot of coffee and a sandwich. It was time to make a close study of the Jacoby file from Birmingham. He scrubbed his reading glasses with hotel soap and settled in by the window with the file. For the first few minutes, he looked up at every sound,
footsteps in the hall, the distant thud of the elevator door. Then he knew nothing but the file. The waiter with the tray knocked and waited, knocked and waited. Finally, he left the lunch on the floor outside the door and signed the bill himself. Chapter 4. Hoyt Lewis, meter reader for Georgia Power Company, parked his truck under a big tree in the alley and settled back with his lunchbox. It was no fun opening his lunch now that he packed it himself. No little notes in there anymore. No surprise Twinkie. He was halfway through his sandwich when a loud voice at his ear made him jump.
"I guess I used $1,000 worth of electricity this month. Is that right?"
Lewis turned and saw at the truck window the red face of H.G. Parsons. Parsons wore Bermuda shorts and carried a yard broom.
"I didn't understand what you said."
"I guess you'll say I used $1,000 worth of electricity this month. Did you hear me that time?"
"I don't know what you've used, because I haven't read your meter yet, Mr. Parsons. When I do read it, I'll put it down on this piece of paper right here."
Parsons was bitter about the size of the bill. He had complained to the power company that he was being prorated.
"I'm keeping up with what I use," Parsons said. "I'm going to the Public Service Commission with it, too."
"You want to read your meter with me?
Let's go over there right now, and..." "I know how to read a meter. I guess you could read one, too, if it wasn't so much trouble."
"Just be quiet a minute, Parsons."
Lewis got out of his truck.
"Just be quiet a minute now, damn it. Last year, you put a magnet on your meter. Your wife said you was in the hospital, so I just took it off and didn't say anything. When you poured molasses in it last winter, I reported it. I noticed you paid up when we charged you for it. Your bill went up after you did all that wiring yourself. I've told you till I'm blue in the face, something in that house is draining off current.
Do you hire an electrician to find it?
No, you call down to the office and bitch about me. I've about got a bait of you."
Lewis was pale with anger.
"I'll get to the bottom of this," Parsons said, retreating down the alley toward his yard. "They're checking up on you, Mr. Lewis. I saw somebody reading your route ahead of you," he said across the fence. "Pretty soon, you'll have to go to work like everybody else."
Lewis cranked his truck and drove on down the alley. Now he would have to find another place to finish his lunch. He was sorry. The big shade tree had been a good lunch place for years. It was directly behind Charles Leeds's house. At 5:30 p.m., Hoyt Lewis drove in his own automobile to the Cloud 9 Lounge, where he had several Boilermakers to ease his mind. When he called his estranged wife, all he could think of to say was, "I wish you was still fixing my lunch."
"You ought to have thought about that, Mr. Smarty," she said, and hung up.
He played a gloomy game of shuffleboard with some linemen and a dispatcher from Georgia Power and looked over the crowd. Goddamned airline clerks had started coming in the Cloud 9. All had the same little mustache and pinky ring. Pretty soon, they'd be fixing the Cloud 9 English with a damn dartboard. You can't depend on nothing.
"Hey, Hoyt, I'm at you for a bottle of beer."
It was his supervisor, Billy Meeks.
"Say, Billy, I need to talk to you."
"What's up?"
"You know that old son-of-a-bitch Parsons that's all the time calling up?"
"Called me last week, as a matter of fact," Meeks said. "What about him?"
"He said somebody was reading my route ahead of me, like maybe somebody thought I wasn't making the rounds. You don't think I'm reading meters at home, do you?"
"Nope."
"You don't think that, do you? I mean, if I'm on a man's shit list, I want him to come right out and say it."
"If he was on my shit list, you think I'd be scared, say so to your face?"
"No."
"All right, then. If anybody was checking your route, I'd know it. Your executives is always aware of a situation like that. Nobody's checking up on you, Hoyt. You can't pay any attention to Parsons. He's just old and contrary. He called me up last week and said, congratulations on getting wise to that Hoyt Lewis. I didn't pay him any mind.
I wish we'd put the law on him about that meter, Lewis said.
I was just sitting back there in the alley under a tree, trying to eat my lunch today, and he jumped me. What he needs is a good ass-kicking.
I used to sit back there myself when I had the root, Meeks said. Boy, I tell you, one time I seen Mrs. Leeds. Well, it don't seem right to talk about it now she's dead. But one or two times she was out there sunning herself in the backyard in her swimming suit. Ooh-wee! And a cute little Peter belly. It was a damn shame about them. She was a nice lady.
Did they catch anybody yet?
No. Too bad he got the Leedses when old Parsons was right down the street convenient, Lewis observed.
I'll tell you what, I don't let my old lady lay around out in the yard in no swimming suit. She goes, silly Billy, who's going to see me?
I told her, I said, you can't tell what kind of an insane bastard might jump over that hedge with his private out.
Did the cops talk to you? Asked you, had you seen anybody?
Yeah, I think they got everybody that has a root out there. Mailman, everybody. I was working Laurel Wood on the other side of Betty Jane Drive the whole week until today, though.
Lewis picked at the label on his beer.
You say Parsons called you up last week?
Yep.
Then he must have saw somebody reading his meter.
He wouldn't have called in if he'd just made it up today to bother me.
You say you didn't send nobody, and it sure wasn't me he saw.
Might have been Southeastern Bell checking something.
Might have been.
We don't share poles out there, though.
Reckon I ought to call the cops?
Wouldn't hurt nothing, Meeks said.
No, it might do Parsons some good. Talk with the law. Scare the shit out of them when they drive up, anyhow.
Chapter 5 Graham went back to the Leeds house in the late afternoon. He entered through the front door and tried not to look at the ruin the killer had left. So far, he had seen files, a killing floor, and meat, all aftermath. He knew a fair amount about how they died. How they lived was on his mind today. A survey, then. The garage contained a good ski boat, well used and well maintained, and a station wagon. Golf clubs were there, and a trail bike. The power tools were almost unused. Adult toys. Graham took a wedge from the golf bag and had to choke up on the long shaft as he made a jerky swing. The bag puffed a smell of leather at him as he leaned it back against the wall. Charles Leeds's things. Graham pursued Charles Leeds through the house. His hunting prints hung in the den. His set of the great books were all in a row. Sewanee Annuals, H. Allen Smith and Perelman and Max Schulman on the bookshelves, Vonnegut and Evelyn Waugh, C.S. Forster's Beat to Quarters was open on a table. In the den closet, a good skeet gun, a Nikon camera, a Bolex Super 8 movie camera and projector. Graham, who owned almost nothing except basic fishing equipment, a third-hand Volkswagen, and two cases of Montrachet, felt a mild animosity toward the adult toys, and wondered why. Who was Leeds? A successful tax attorney, a Sewanee footballer, a rangy man who liked to laugh, a man who got up and fought with his throat cut. Graham followed him through the house out of an odd sense of obligation. Learning about him first was a way of asking permission to look at his wife. Graham felt that it was she who drew the monster, as surely as a singing cricket attracts death from the red-eyed fly. Mrs. Leeds, then. She had a small dressing room upstairs. Graham managed to reach it without looking around the bedroom. The room was yellow and appeared undisturbed except for the smashed mirror above the dressing table. A pair of L.L. Bean moccasins was on the floor in front of the closet, as though she had just stepped out of them. Her dressing gown appeared to have been flung on its peg, and the closet revealed the mild disorder of a woman who has many other closets to organize. Mrs. Leeds' diary was in a plum velvet box on the dressing table. The key was taped to the lid along with a check tag from the police property room. Graham sat on a spindly white chair and opened the diary at random. December 23rd, Tuesday, Mama's house. The children are still asleep. When Mama glassed in the sun porch, I hated the way it changed the looks of the house, but it's very pleasant, and I can sit here warm looking out at the snow. How many more Christmases can she manage a house full of grandchildren? A lot, I hope. A hard drive yesterday up from Atlanta, snowing after Raleigh. We had to creep. I was tired anyway from getting everyone ready. Outside Chapel Hill, Charlie stopped the car and got out. He snapped some icicles off a branch to make me a martini. He came back to the car, long legs lifting high in the snow, and there was snow in his hair and on his eyelashes, and I remembered that I love him. It felt like something breaking with a little pain and spilling warm. I hope the parka fits him. If he got me that tacky dinner ring, I'll die. I could kick Madeline's big cellulite behind for showing hers and carrying on. 4 ridiculously big diamonds, the color of dirty ice. Icicle ice is so clear. The sun came through the car window, and where the icicle was broken off, it stuck up out of the glass and made a little prism. It made a spot of red and green on my hand holding the glass. I could feel the colors on my hand. He asked me what I want for Christmas, and I cupped my hands around his ear and whispered, "You're a big prick, silly, in as far as it will go." The bald spot on the back of his head turned red. He's always afraid the children will hear. Men have no confidence in whispers. The page was flecked with detectives' cigar ash. Graham read on as the light faded, through the daughter's tonsillectomy and a scare in June when Mrs. Leeds found a small lump in her breast. Dear God, the children are so small. 3 pages later, the lump was a small, benign cyst, easily removed. Dr. Janovich turned me loose this afternoon. We left the hospital and drove to the pond. We hadn't been there in a long while. There never seems to be enough time. Charlie had 2 bottles of champagne on ice, and we drank them and fed the ducks while the sun went down. He stood at edge of the water with his back to me for a while, and I think he cried a little. Susan said she was afraid we were coming home from the hospital with another brother for her. Home. Graham heard the telephone ring in the bedroom. A click and the hum of an answering machine. "Hello. This is Valerie Leeds. I'm sorry I can't come to the phone right now, but if you'll leave your name and number after the tone, we'll get back to you. Thank you." Graham half expected to hear Crawford's voice after the beep, but there was only the dial tone. The caller had hung up. He had heard her voice. Now he wanted to see her. He went down to the den. He had in his pocket a reel of Super 8 movie film belonging to Charles Leeds. 3 weeks before his death, Leeds had left the film with a druggist who sent it away for processing. He never picked it up. Police found the receipt in Leeds' wallet and got the film from the druggist. Detectives viewed the home movie along with family snapshots developed at the same time and found nothing of interest. Graham wanted to see the Leedses alive. At the police station, the detectives had offered Graham their projector. He wanted to watch the movie at the house. Reluctantly, they let him check it out of the property room. Graham found the screen and projector in the den closet, set them up, and sat down in Charles Leeds's big leather armchair to watch. He felt something tacky on the chair arm under his palm. A child's sticky fingerprints fuzzed with lint. Graham's hand smelled like candy. It was a pleasant little silent home movie, more imaginative than most. It opened with a dog, a gray Scotty, asleep on the den rug. The dog was disturbed momentarily by the movie making and raised his head to look at the camera. Then he went to sleep again. A jumpy cut to the dog still asleep. Then the Scotty's ears perked up. He rose and barked, and the camera followed him into the kitchen as he ran to the door and stood expectantly, shivering and wagging his stumpy tail. Graham bit his lower lip and waited too. On the screen, the door opened, and Mrs. Leeds came in, carrying groceries. She blinked and laughed in surprise and touched her tousled hair with her free hand. Her lips moved as she walked out of the picture, and the children came in behind her, carrying smaller sacks. The girl was 6, the boys 8 and 10. The younger boy, apparently a veteran of home movies, pointed to his ears and wiggled them. The camera was positioned fairly high. Leeds was 75 inches tall, according to the coroner's report. Graham believed that this part of the movie must have been made in the early spring. The children wore windbreakers, and Mrs. Leeds appeared pale. At the morgue, she had a good tan and bathing suit marks. Brief scenes followed of the boys playing ping-pong in the basement, and the girl, Susan, wrapping a present in her room, tongue curled over her upper lip in concentration, and a wisp of hair down over her forehead. She brushed her hair back with her plump hand, as her mother had done in the kitchen. A subsequent scene showed Susan in a bubble bath, crouched like a small frog. She wore a large shower cap. The camera angle was lower and the focus uncertain, clearly the work of a brother. The scene ended with her shouting soundlessly at the camera and covering her 6-year-old chest as her shower cap slipped down over her eyes. Not to be outdone, Leeds had surprised Mrs. Leeds in the shower. The shower curtain bumped and bulged as the curtain does before a grade school theatrical. Mrs. Leeds's arm appeared around the curtain. In her hand was a large bath sponge. The scene closed with the lens obscured in soap suds. The film ended with a shot of Norman Vincent Peale speaking on television and a pan to Charles Leeds snoring in the chair where Graham now sat. Graham stared at the blank square of light on the screen. He liked the Leedses. He was sorry that he had been to the morgue. He thought the madman who visited them might have liked them too. But the madman would like them better the way they were now. Graham's head felt stuffed and stupid. He swam in the pool at his hotel until he was rubber-legged and came out of the water thinking of 2 things at once, a Tanqueray martini and the taste of Molly's mouth. He made the martini himself in a plastic glass and telephoned Molly. "Hello, Hotshot."
"Hey, baby, where are you?"
"In this damned hotel in Atlanta."
"Doing some good?"
"None you'd notice. I'm lonesome."
"Me too."
"Horny."
"Me too."
"Tell me about yourself."
"Well, I had a run-in with Mrs. Holper today. She wanted to return a dress with a huge, big whiskey stain on the seat. I mean, obviously she had worn it to the JC thing."
"And what did you say?"
"I told her I didn't sell it to her like that."
"And what did she say?"
"She said she never had any trouble returning dresses before, which was one reason she shopped at my place, rather than some others that she knew about."
"And then what did you say?"
I said I was upset because Will talks like a jackass on the phone."
"I see."
"Willie's fine. He's covering some turtle eggs the dogs dug up. Tell me what you're doing."
"Reading reports, eating junk food."
"Thinking a good bit, I expect."
"Yep."
"Can I help you?"
"I just don't have a lock on anything, Molly. There's not enough information. Well, there's a lot of information, but I haven't done enough with it."
"Will you be in Atlanta for a while? I'm not bugging you about coming home. I just wonder."
"I don't know. I'll be here a few more days at least. I miss you."
"Want to talk about fucking?"
"I don't think I could stand it. I think maybe we better not do that."
Do what?
Talk about fucking.
Okay. You don't mind if I think about it, though?
Absolutely not.
We've got a new dog.
Oh, hell.
Looks like a cross between a basset hound and a Pekingese.
Lovely.
He's got big balls.
Never mind about his balls.
They almost drag the ground. He has to retract them when he runs.
He can't do that.
Yes, he can. You don't know.
Yes, I do know.
Can you retract yours?
I thought we were coming to that.
Well,
if you must know, I retracted them once.
When was that?
In my youth, I had to clear a barbed wire fence in a hurry.
Why?
I was carrying this watermelon that I had not cultivated.
You were fleeing? From whom?
A swineherd of my acquaintance. Alerted by his dogs, he burst from his dwelling in his BVDs, waving a fowling piece. Fortunately, he tripped over a butterbean trellis and gave me a running start.
Did he shoot at you?
I thought so at the time, yes. But the reports I heard might have issued from my behind. I've never been entirely clear on that.
Did you clear the fence?
Handily.
A criminal mind, even at that age.
I don't have a criminal mind.
Of course you don't. I'm thinking about painting the kitchen. What color do you like, Will? What color do you like? Are you there?
Yellow.
Let's paint it yellow. Yellow is a bad color for me. I'll look green at breakfast.
Blue, then.
Blue is cold.
Well, goddammit, painted baby shit tan for all I care.
No, look. I'll probably be home before long, and we'll go to the paint store and get some chips and stuff, okay? And maybe some new handles and that. Let's get some handles. I don't know why I'm talking about this stuff. Look, I love you, and I miss you, and you're doing the right thing. It's costing you, too, I know that. I'm here, and I'll be here whenever you come home, or I'll meet you anywhere, anytime. That's what.
Dear Molly, go to bed now.
All right.
Good night.
Graham lay with his hands behind his head and conjured dinners with Molly, stone crab and sancerre, the salt breeze mixed with the wine. But it was his curse to pick at conversations, and he began to do it now. He had snapped at her after a harmless remark about his criminal mind. Stupid. Graham found Molly's interest in him largely inexplicable. He called police headquarters and left word for Springfield that he wanted to start helping with the legwork in the morning. There was nothing else to do. The gin helped him sleep.
Chapter 6
Flimsy copies of the notes on all calls about the Leeds case were placed on Buddy Springfield's desk. Tuesday morning at 7 o'clock, when Springfield arrived at his office, there were 63 of them. The top one was red-flagged. It said Birmingham police had found a cat buried in a shoebox behind the Jacoby's garage. The cat had a flower between its paws and was wrapped in a dish towel. The cat's name was written on the lid in a childish hand. It wore no collar. A string tied in a granny knot held the lid on. The Birmingham medical examiner said the cat was strangled. He had shaved it and found no puncture wound. Springfield tapped the earpiece of his glasses against his teeth. They had found soft ground and dug it up with a shovel. Didn't need any damned methane probe. Still, Graham had been right. The chief of detectives licked his thumb and started through the rest of the stack of flimsies. Most were reports of suspicious vehicles in the neighborhood during the past week, vague descriptions giving only vehicle type or color. Four anonymous telephone callers had told Atlanta residents, "I'm gonna do you like the Leedses." Hoyt Lewis's report was in the middle of the pile. Springfield called the overnight watch commander. "What about the meter reader's report on this Parsons number 48?
We tried to check with the utilities last night, Chief, to see if they had anybody in that alley, the watch commander said. They'll have to get back to us this morning.
You have somebody get back to them now, Springfield said. Check sanitation, the city engineer, check for construction permits along the alley, and catch me in my car.
He dialed Will Graham's number.
Will, meet me in front of your hotel in 10 minutes, and let's take a little ride.
At 7:45 a.m., Springfield parked near the end of the alley. He and Graham walked abreast in wheel tracks pressed in the gravel. Even this early, the sun was hot.
You need to get you a hat, Springfield said.
His own snappy straw was tilted down over his eyes. The chain-link fence at the rear of the Leeds property was covered with vines. They paused by the light meter on the pole.
If he came down this way, he could see the whole back end of the house, Springfield said.
In only 5 days, the Leeds property had begun to look neglected. The lawn was uneven, and wild onions sprouted above the grass. Small branches had fallen in the yard. Graham wanted to pick them up. The house seemed asleep, the latticed porch striped and dappled with the long morning shadows of the trees. Standing with Springfield in the alley, Graham could see himself looking in the back window, opening the porch door. Oddly, his reconstruction of the entry by the killer seemed to elude him now in the sunlight. He watched a child's swing move gently in the breeze.
"That looks like Parsons," Springfield said.
H.G. Parsons was out early, grubbing in a flower bed in his backyard 2 houses down. Springfield and Graham went to Parsons' back gate and stood beside his garbage cans. The lids were chained to the fence. Springfield measured the height of the light meter with a tape. He had notes on all the Leeds' neighbors. His notes said Parsons had taken early retirement from the post office at his supervisor's request. The supervisor had reported Parsons to be increasingly absent-minded. Springfield's notes contained gossip, too. The neighbors said Parsons' wife stayed with her sister in Macon as much as she could, and that his son never called him anymore.
"Mr. Parsons! Mr. Parsons!" Springfield called.
Parsons leaned his tilling fork against the house and came to the fence. He wore sandals and white socks. Dirt and grass had stained the toes of his socks. His face was shiny pink. Arteriosclerosis, Graham thought. He's taken his pill.
Yes?
Mr. Parsons, could we talk to you for a minute? We were hoping you could help us, Springfield said.
Are you from the power company?
No, I'm Buddy Springfield from the police department.
It's about the murder, then. My wife and I were in Macon, as I told the officer.
I know, Mr. Parsons. We wanted to ask about your light meter.
If that meter reader said I did anything improper, he's just...
No, Mr. Parsons. Did you see a stranger reading your meter last week?
No.
Are you sure? I believe you told Hoyt Lewis that someone else read your meter ahead of him.
I did, and it's about time. I'm keeping up with this, and the Public Service Commission will get a full report from me.
Yes, sir, I'm sure they'll take care of it. Who did you see reading your meter?
It wasn't a stranger. It was somebody from Georgia Power.
How do you know?
Well, he looked like a meter reader.
What was he wearing?
Well, they all wear, I guess. What is it, a brown outfit and a cap?
Did you see his face?
I can't remember if I did. I was looking out the kitchen window when I saw him. I wanted to talk to him, but I had to put on my robe, and by the time I got outside, he was gone.
Did he have a truck?
I don't remember seeing one. What's going on? Why do you want to know?
We're checking everybody who was in this neighborhood last week. It's really important, Mr. Parsons. Try hard to remember.
So it is about the murder. You haven't arrested anybody yet, have you?
No.
I watched the street last night, and 15 minutes went by without a single squad car passing. It was horrible what happened to the Leedses. My wife has been beside herself. I wonder who bought their house. I saw some Negroes looking at it the other day. You know, I had speak to Leeds a few times about his children, but they were all right. Of course, he wouldn't do anything I suggested about his lawn. The Department of Agriculture has some excellent pamphlets on the control of nuisance grasses. Finally, I just put them in his mailbox. Honestly, when he mowed, the wild onions were suffocating.
Mr. Parsons, exactly when did you see this fella in the alley? Springfield asked.
I'm not sure. I was trying to think.
Do you recall the time of day, morning, noon, afternoon?
I know the times of day. You don't have to name them. Afternoon, maybe. I don't remember.
Springfield rubbed the back of his neck. Excuse me, Mr. Parsons, but I have to get this just right. Could we go in your kitchen and you show us just where you saw him from?
Let me see your credentials, both of you.
In the house, silence, shiny surfaces, and dead air. Neat. Neat. The desperate order of an aging couple who see their lives begin to blur. Graham wished he had stayed outside. He was sure the drawers held polished silver with egg between the tines. Stop it, and let's pump the old fart. The window over the kitchen sink gave a good view of the backyard.
There. Are you satisfied?
Parsons asked.
You can see out there from here. I never talked to him. I don't remember what he looked like. If that's all, I have a lot to do.
Graham spoke for the first time. You said you went to get your robe, and when you came back he was gone. You weren't dressed then?
No.
In the middle of the afternoon, were you not feeling well, Mr. Parsons?
What I do in my own house is my business. I can wear a kangaroo suit in here if I want to. Why aren't you out looking for the killer? Probably because it's cool in here.
I understand you're retired, Mr. Parsons, so I guess it doesn't matter if you put on your clothes every day or not. A lot of days you just don't get dressed at all, am I right?
Veins stood out in Parsons' temples. Just because I'm retired doesn't mean I don't put my clothes on and get busy every day. I just got hot and I came in and took a shower. I was working, I was mulching, and I had done a day's work by afternoon, which is more than you'll do today.
You were what?
Mulching.
What day did you mulch?
Friday. It was last Friday. They delivered it in the morning, a big load, and I had it all spread by afternoon. You can ask at the garden center how much it was.
And you got hot and came in and took a shower. What were you doing in the kitchen?
Fixing a glass of iced tea.
And you got out some ice? But the refrigerator is over there, away from the window. Parsons looked from the window to the refrigerator, lost and confused. His eyes were dull, like the eyes of a fish in the market toward the end of the day. Then they brightened in triumph. He went to the cabinet by the sink.
I was right here, getting some sweet and low when I saw him. That's it. That's all. Now, if you're through prying...
I think he saw Hoyt Lewis, Graham said.
So do I. Springfield said.
It was not Hoyt Lewis. It was not.
Parsons' eyes were watering.
How do you know? Springfield said. It might have been Hoyt Lewis, and you just thought.
Lewis is brown from the sun. He's got old greasy hair and those peckerwood sideburns.
Parsons' voice had risen, and he was talking so fast it was hard to understand him.
That's how I knew. Of course it wasn't Lewis. His fellow was paler and his hair was blonde. He turned to write on his clipboard and I could see under the back of his hat. Blonde. Cut off square on the back of his neck.
Springfield stood absolutely still, and when he spoke, his voice was still skeptical.
What about his face?
I don't know. He may have had a mustache.
Like Lewis.
Lewis doesn't have a mustache.
Oh. Springfield said.
Was he at eye level with the meter? Did he have to look up at it?
Eye level, I guess.
Would you know him if you saw him again?
No.
What age was he?
Not old. I don't know.
Did you see the Leeds' dog anywhere around him?
No.
Look, Mr. Parsons, I can see I was wrong, Springfield said. You're a real big help to us. If you don't mind, I'm going to send our artist out here, and if you just let him sit right here at your kitchen table, maybe you could give him an idea of what this fella looked like. It sure wasn't Lewis.
I don't want my name in any newspapers.
It won't be. Parsons followed them outside.
You've done a hell of a fine job on this yard, Mr. Parsons, Springfield said. It ought to win some kind of a prize.
Parsons said nothing. His face was red and working, his eyes wet. He stood there in his baggy shorts and sandals and glared at them. As they left the yard, he grabbed his fork and began to grub furiously in the ground, hacking blindly through the flowers, scattering mulch on the grass. Springfield checked in on his car radio. None of the utilities or city agencies could account for the man in the alley on the day before the murders. Springfield reported Parsons' description and gave instructions for the artist.
Tell him to draw the pole and the meter first, and go from there. He'll have to ease the witness along.
Our artist doesn't much like to make house calls, the chief of detectives told Graham as he slid the strip line forward through the traffic. He likes for the secretaries to see him work, with the witness standing on one foot and then the other, looking over his shoulder. A police station is a damn poor place to question anybody that you don't need to scare. Soon as we get the picture, we'll door-to-door the neighborhood with it.
I feel like we just got a whiff, Will.
Just faint, but a whiff, don't you? Look, we did it to the poor old devil, and he came through. Now, let's do something with it.
If the man in the alley is the one we want, it's the best news yet, Graham said. He was sick of himself.
Right. It means he's not just getting off a bus and going whichever way his Peter points. He's got a plan. He stayed in town overnight. He knows where he's going a day or two ahead. He's got some kind of an idea. Case the place, kill the pet, then the family.
What the hell kind of an idea is that? Springfield paused.
That's kind of your territory, isn't it?
It is, yes. If it's anybody's, I suppose it's mine.
I know you've seen this kind of thing before. You didn't like it the other day when I asked you about Lecter, but I need to talk to you about it.
All right.
He killed 9 people, didn't he, in all?
9 that we know of. 2 others didn't die.
What happened to them?
One is on a respirator at a hospital in Baltimore. The other is in a private mental hospital in Denver.
What made him do it? How was he crazy?
Graham looked out the car window at the people on the sidewalk. His voice sounded detached, as though he were dictating a letter.
He did it because he liked it. Still does.
Dr. Lecter is not crazy in any common way we think of being crazy. He did some hideous things because he enjoyed them. But he can function perfectly when he wants to.
What did the psychologists call it? What was wrong with him?
They say he's a sociopath because they don't know what else to call him. He has some of the characteristics of what they call a sociopath. He has no remorse or guilt at all. And he had the first and worst sign, sadism to animals as a child.
Springfield grunted.
But he doesn't have any of the other marks, Graham said. He wasn't a drifter. He had no history of trouble with the law. He wasn't shallow and exploitive in small things like most sociopaths are. He's not insensitive. They don't know what to call him. His electroencephalograms show some odd patterns, but they haven't been able to tell much from them.
"What would you call him?" Springfield asked. Graham hesitated.
"Just to yourself, what do you call him?"
"He's a monster. I think of him as one of those pitiful things that are born in hospitals from time to time. They feed it and keep it warm, but they don't put it on the machines, and it dies. Lecter is the same way in his head, but he looks normal and nobody could tell. A couple of friends of mine in the Chiefs Association are from Baltimore. I asked them how you spotted Lecter. They said they didn't know. How did you do it? What was the first indication, first thing you felt?
It was a coincidence, Graham said.
The sixth victim was killed in his workshop. He had woodworking equipment, and he kept his hunting stuff out there. He was laced to a pegboard where the tools hung, and he was really torn up, cut and stabbed, and he had arrows in him. The wounds reminded me of something. I couldn't think what it was.
And you had to go on to the next ones?
Yes. Lecter was very hot. He did the next three in 9 days. But this sixth one, he had two old scars on his thigh. The pathologist checked with the local hospital and found he had fallen out of a tree blind 5 years before while he was bow hunting and stuck an arrow through his leg. The doctor of record was a resident surgeon, but Lecter had treated him first. He was on duty in the emergency room. His name was on the admissions log. It had been a long time since the accident, but I thought Lecter might remember if anything had seemed fishy about the arrow wound, so I went to his office to see him. We were grabbing at anything then. He was practicing psychiatry by that time. He had a nice office. Antiques. He said he didn't remember much about the arrow wound, that one of the victim's hunting buddies had brought him in, and that was it. Something bothered me, though. I thought it was something Lecter said, or something in the office. Crawford and I hashed it over. We checked the files, and Lecter had no record. I wanted some time in his office by myself, but we couldn't get a warrant. We had nothing to show. So I went back to see him. It was Sunday. He saw patients on Sunday. The building was empty, except for a couple of people in his waiting room. He saw me right away. We were talking, and he was making this polite effort to help me, and I looked up at some very old medical books on the shelf above his head, and I knew it was him. When I looked at him again, maybe my face changed, I don't know. I knew it, and he knew I knew it. I still couldn't think of the reason, though. I didn't trust it. I had to figure it out. So I mumbled something and got out of there into the hall. There was a payphone in the hall. I didn't want to stir him up until I had some help. I was talking to the police switchboard when he came out of a service door behind me in his socks. I never heard him coming. I felt his breath was all, and then there was the rest of it.
How did you know, though?
I think it was maybe a week later in the hospital I finally figured it out. It was Wound Man, an illustration they used in a lot of the early medical books, like the ones Lecter had. It shows different kinds of battle injuries, all in one figure. I had seen it in a survey course a pathologist was teaching at GWU. This sixth victim's position and his injuries were a close match to Wound Man.
Wound Man, you say? That's all you had?
Well, yeah, it was a coincidence that I had seen it. A piece of luck.
That's some luck.
If you don't believe me, what the fuck did you ask me for?
I didn't hear that.
Good. I didn't mean to say it. That's the way it happened, though.
Okay, Springfield said. Okay. Thank you for telling me. I need to know things like that.
Parsons' description of the man in the alley and the information on the cat and the dog were possible indications of the killer's methods. It seemed likely that he scouted as a meter reader and felt compelled to hurt the victim's pets before he came to kill the family. The immediate problem the police faced was whether or not to publicize their theory. With the public aware of the danger signals and watching, police might get advance warning of the killer's next attack, but the killer probably followed the news, too. He might change his habits. There was strong feeling in the police department that the slender leads should be kept secret except for a special bulletin to veterinarians and animal shelters throughout the southeast asking for immediate reports on pet mutilations. That meant not giving the public the best possible warning. It was a moral question, and the police were not comfortable with it. They consulted Dr. Alan Bloom in Chicago. Dr. Bloom said that if the killer read a warning in the newspapers, he would probably change his method of casing a house. Dr. Bloom doubted that the man could stop attacking the pets, regardless of the risk. A psychiatrist told the police that they should by no means assume they had 25 days to work, the period before the next full moon on August 25th. On the morning of July 31st, 3 hours after Parsons gave his description, a decision was reached in a telephone conference among Birmingham and Atlanta police and Crawford in Washington. They would send the private bulletin to veterinarians, canvass for 3 days in the neighborhood with the artist's sketch, then release the information to the news media. For those 3 days, Graham and the Atlanta detectives pounded the sidewalks, showing the sketch to householders in the area of the Leeds home. There was only a suggestion of a face in the sketch, but they hoped to find someone who could improve it. Graham's copy of the sketch grew soft around the edges from the sweat of his hands. Often it was difficult to get residents to answer the door. At night, he lay in his room with powder on his heat rash, his mind circling the problem as though it were a hologram. He courted the feeling that precedes an idea. It would not come. Meanwhile, there were 4 accidental injuries and 1 fatality in Atlanta as householders shot at relatives coming home late. Prowler calls multiplied and useless tips stacked up in the inn baskets at police headquarters. Despair went around like the flu. Crawford returned from Washington at the end of the 3rd day and dropped in on Graham as he sat peeling off his wet socks. "Hot work?" "Grab a sketch in the morning and see," Graham said. "No, it'll be all on the news tonight. Did you walk all day?" "I can't drive through their yards." "I didn't think anything would come of this canvas," Crawford said.
"Well, what the hell did you expect me to do?"
"The best you can, that's all." Crawford rose to leave. "Busy work's been a narcotic for me sometimes, especially after I quit the booze. For you too, I think." Graham was angry. Crawford was right, of course. Graham was a natural procrastinator, and he knew it. Long ago in school, he had made up for it with speed. He was not in school now. There was something else he could do, and he had known it for days. He could wait until he was driven to it by desperation in the last days before the full moon. Or he could do it now, while it might be of some use. There was an opinion he wanted. A very strange view he needed to share, a mindset he had to recover after his warm, round years in the Keys. The reasons clacked like roller coaster cogs, pulling up to the first long plunge, and at the top, unaware that he clutched his belly, Graham said it aloud. "I have to see Lecter." Chapter 7. Dr. Frederick Chilton, chief of staff at the Baltimore State Hospital for the Criminally Insane, came around his desk to shake Will Graham's hand. "Dr. Bloom called me yesterday, Mr. Graham, or should I call you Dr. Graham?" "I'm not a doctor." I was delighted to hear from Dr. Bloom. We've known each other for years. Take that chair. We appreciate your help, Dr. Chilton. Frankly, I sometimes feel like Lecter's secretary rather than his keeper, Chilton said. The volume of his mail alone is a nuisance. I think among some researchers, it's considered chic to correspond with him. I've seen his letters framed in psychology departments. And for a while, it seemed that every Ph.D. candidate in the field wanted to interview him. Glad to cooperate with you, of course, and Dr. Bloom.
I need to see Dr. Lecter in as much privacy as possible, Graham said. I may need to see him again or telephone him after today.
Chilton nodded. To begin with, Dr. Lecter will stay in his room. That is absolutely the only place where he is not put in restraints. One wall of his room is a double barrier which opens on the hall. I'll have a chair put there and screens if you like. I must ask you not to pass him any objects whatever, other than paper, free of clips or staples. No